Did you think I'd forgotten you?
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is February 28th. February 28th. Folks, do we even really need February? A 28-day month. I mean, this is getting ridiculous. So anyway, I managed to peel myself away from Netflix to record this intro for you. House of Cards is back. If you have not seen House of Cards, get into House of Cards. In fact, if you quit your job or drop out of high school or college, you could probably watch the whole series next week. You know, of course, talk to your employer or your parents before making a decision like that when you are going to be altering your life drastically to fit in a TV show. It's best to have open lines of communication with other people who might be affected by that decision. It's a great show. Kevin Spacey. I love Kevin Spacey. So good. So good. And you know what else? The cinematography is amazing. So many times I've been watching that show and I've said, how do they even light this scene? My goodness. Good heavens. Lighting. So important. Telling stories. A couple of quick notes before we get started. I am recording today for the first time on a new computer. And I want to publicly thank somebody who has been a longtime content contributor to the show. Some really valuable content. Tony Myers. He has built for us a new supercomputer. Now, I don't know if that's the correct term. I don't know if there's a certain criteria the computer has to meet to officially earn the label of supercomputer, but this one's pretty damn super, folks. And it will allow me to do every single thing I want related to this show from the seat I'm in right now. And I'm really excited. I also want to thank a listener named Harold O. The other day, as I've been trying to finish up this new studio, I said to myself, I really need a new monitor. I really need to get a new monitor. So I went to eBay and I started shopping around. I just couldn't pull the trigger on anything one night. Next day, I'm not even kidding, a package shows up in a beautiful blue bag. Once you open the box, a beautiful blue bag with a yellow bow on it. And it's from Harold, and it is a 24-inch Asus LED monitor that I am watching the visual representation of my voice on right now. And I'm so thrilled. This studio needs a name. You know, all great studios have names. This is a great studio. You heard what Derek J had to say about it. It's twice as good now as it was when he was here. If he was here today, we could have streamed that show live, probably in HD. So please send in your name suggestions. I don't want to just call it School Sucks Project Studio. So again, huge thanks to everybody. I have to say, I have never been more optimistic than I am right now. Things have never been better than they are right now, as far as School Sucks Project is concerned. So anyway, on the show today, Nick Hazelton. I appeared on his show about a month ago. He does the Anarcho-Yakitalist podcast. You might remember Nick from episode 300 of School Sucks. He got really, really skeptical about school about a year ago. You might remember he called into Free Talk Live. Ian and I talked to him, and he said that he was interested in dropping out of school to pursue yak herding. And shortly after that, I had him on my show. Shortly after that, he was added to the rotation of the Freedom Fiends radio show. You can hear him there, I think, once a week. And we reconvened. He wanted to interview me about schooling versus education and to talk a little bit more philosophy. I posted a 30-minute clip of our discussion in the AV Club about a month ago, maybe the day after we recorded. And somebody said, you know, that's really, you should put that out. So I'm going to put out about an hour of that discussion for you today. We talk about school. We talk about philosophy. We talk about the non-aggression principle. And I do want to say this. I do want to lay some groundwork before we start, because we do a figure skater-like change of direction about 10 minutes in. We're talking about education. We switch to philosophy very rapidly. Nick considers himself a nihilist. And in our last discussion, I, you know, tried to talk about some of my objections to the philosophy of nihilism. I introduced objectivism. I suggested it was something worth looking into. And this is a little update. Some of you might be unfamiliar with nihilism, especially those of you who didn't hear the show that we did before. So I just wanted to give you a definition, and this is just your basic getting started look from Wikipedia. Nihilism is a philosophical doctrine that suggests the negation of one or more reputedly meaningful aspects of life. Most commonly, nihilism is presented in the form of existential nihilism, which argues that life is without objective meaning, purpose, or intrinsic value. Moral nihilists assert that morality does not inherently exist and that any established moral values are abstractly contrived. Nihilism can also take epistemological or ontological metaphysical forms, meaning respectively that in some aspect knowledge is not possible or that reality does not actually exist. You also hear in our discussion the term polycentric law. Polycentric law is a legal structure in which providers of legal systems compete or overlap in a given jurisdiction, as opposed to monopolistic statutory law, according to which there is a sole provider of law for each jurisdiction. And the go-to guy on polycentric law is Tom W. Bell. He's a professor of law at the Chapman University School of Law, so I will link to some of his stuff in the show notes. Fascinating history, actually something I might like to do a show about in the future. So let's get to it. This is about a 55-minute selection from a two-hour discussion. We start already in progress. Nick is asking me about how I might dissuade somebody who's interested in providing real education for young people from the career of public school teaching. So here we go.
If somebody's thinking about becoming a public school teacher and they're doing it because they want to provide a quality education for people, how do you provide a quality education for kids? All the teachers at my school, from what I've experienced, they do enjoy what they do, and they enjoy working with kids. That's why I became a teacher. And all the teachers we've had have been there for at least a couple of years. I guess we got a new one this year. But I have a cousin who's, he obviously wants to do this, and he wants to do it because he likes to work with kids and he finds it valuable. And I don't really know how to tell him, well, hey, have you ever thought of doing something outside of the public schooling system? But, you know, if you could meet with this person, what would you tell them?
So if I knew them fairly well, I would ask them why, and I would learn basically, you know, what you just said, that they were committed to basically providing a high quality education to young people. So, I mean, I would start with questions. Why do you think school does that? And what was your school experience like? Most of the things you know today, would you say you learned them in school? What would be some examples of that? You're really not going to get anywhere with anybody by immediately trying to rock their whole worldview with all of your facts. So if I'm going to sell them on the idea that if you care about the education of children, this is not the best path for you to follow. Before I can sell, I want to build a rapport, you know, and I kind of also would want to analyze their needs, you know, like what's in it for you? Why do you want to do that? And a good way to build a rapport and see what somebody's trying to get out of something is to ask questions. I mean, that's basically the sales process. Build a rapport, analyze needs, and make a recommendation, you know? So, I mean, maybe the person says, ha ha, just kidding, I'm, you know, a power hungry. And I would say, oh, well, okay, then, you know, maybe you're on the right path. Or it's really important that people listen to me, even though I don't know that much. Okay, then, you know, maybe you're doing the right thing. But that's not why people go into teaching. People don't go into teaching because they want to do power trips on kids. You know, they go into it for the very reason you gave, that they are enthusiastic about making a positive difference in the lives of young people. I would say that's why people teach today, because they know it's not a lot of money. Maybe these are people who don't feel like they have a lot of other options. I mean, I know my mom was a teacher, but she started teaching in like 1972, and she did it because they told her, because she's a woman, she could either be a nurse or a secretary or a teacher, and she picked teacher. So, I mean, there's lots of other reasons why people would do it, but I think usually people have good intentions. So I would need to know a lot more about what the person wanted, what their school experience had been like, what their attitude towards schooling was, and I would proceed from there. So we could role play that if you want, but I think that that's the best strategy when you're talking to anybody about anything that is going to potentially be contentious. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't really want to play it through, but...
Sure.
But yeah, I think that that's definitely a great thing to do. I think that's kind of what you want to do in general when discussing ideas with people, or just pretty much if you want to convince anybody of anything, You don't just throw hard facts at them. Well, you know, you don't just say that education system sucks. You shouldn't be part of it because you're going to perpetuate it or whatever. You know, I think it is a good thing to listen to people, because I think people always have good intentions. Nobody thinks that they're evil and they want to do terrible things.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And I do think that it's a noble thing to want to be able to, you know, teach the next generation. I think that's a great thing to do, but I don't think that public and compulsory schooling is the best way to do that.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And I would hope that I would have enough time with that person to at least convey that idea. But because the deck is so stacked against you as the person who's arguing from the philosophy of liberty or alternative education, you really have to be careful about how you do it if you want to have an impact at all. Because these people can go back to their college friends, they can go back to their professors, they can go back to their New York Times, and they can say, oh, phew, I thought I was going to have to take that person seriously, but here's a community of people who think and talk like me. People retreat to their comfort zones. And the easiest way to retreat to your comfort zone, if you are a school supporter or, you know, a big Obama guy or whatever, is to tell yourself a story about how the person who made so much sense and asked so many tough questions was actually an idiot or an insane person, you know? And if you're hostile in your presentation, it's easier for them to do that. So yeah, I try to be really, really careful, because even though I think we're making progress with liberty, we're making progress with alternative education, the momentum is really, really still going the other way. And communication, it needs to be a really, really important part of the philosophy of liberty. I feel like I started so many conversations with like, oh, okay, I see the problem. You're an idiot and I'm a smart guy and you need my help. And that doesn't get you anywhere, you know? So question, authentic questions, not trap questions, which were basically designed to catch people in their own contradictions.
I totally agree, because in my short experience in trying to evangelize liberty, I've found that people don't like to listen to you just talk.
Yeah.
And this goes for with everything in life, not even, you know, preaching your ideas. You just don't like, people don't like to be talked at.
Right.
Yeah. So involving somebody in that process of, and working through the thought process to getting to a certain point is really beneficial. You know, it's that old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. So I think what I like to do is I set up this line of questioning. Why do you think we need to do this? And, you know, get eventually, get down to, well, is there a better solution? Do you think that we could do this in any better way? And Larkin Rose has been the person that I think of whenever I say this, is that he doesn't ever give a solution, at least in his book, The Most Dangerous Superstition. He doesn't give a solution to getting rid of government. He doesn't say, we need to do this and this and this to get rid of bad authority, right? To get rid of authority. He says, well, you know, I don't really know, but do you have any ideas? And I think that's a really great way to do it.
Yeah, Larkin is...
In every situation.
Yeah, he's really masterful when it comes to the dialectic, you know, the conversation that leads people to... new realizations, you know, even if he's just having it with himself and a made up character, you know, he's really good at that. Larkin is good for people who already get it to help make their arguments more concrete. He's really, really good at that. And I think that like some people with thicker skin could be introduced to liberty through Larkin Rose because he's so entertaining. But he would admit that he is abrasive. And if you're dealing with somebody who's fairly defensive or contentious discussions, that might not be the best approach again.
Yeah, I think I introduced my grandfather to Larkin Rose as one of his beginning points.
Sure.
And he really liked it. He actually, or maybe my grandpa discovered him on his own, but he bought me that book, The Most Dangerous Superstition.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought it was just a brilliant book, and I even wrote a paper based off of it, and it was one of my best papers I've ever written for school. It was a really great book. I love the way that he wrote, but I haven't read any of his other books, but you know, that one was really great.
Yeah, yeah, that's the only book of his that I've read, and I loved it.
Yeah, and I went back to your archive and I listened to all of the Logic Saves Lives. Not that those were a great
thanks
place to start with people. I need to introduce more people to that. You know, I'm really big into critical thinking. I've stepped away from political ideology, you know, talking about it as much rather than just saying, you know, giving those skeptical questions. Because, you know, for one thing, I'm a skeptic hard to the just the, I guess, the nihilist side, right?
Yeah.
And I want to get into this later, right now, if you have enough time.
Oh, sure. Yeah, but I'd love to do that.
Great. So, yeah, this will lead us into that discussion, because I love the Logic Saves Life series. And then there's one episode with Wes Bertrand. What is it? The Stolen Concept Fallacy.
Yes.
I've been studying this a little bit more just recently. I'm writing an essay about the Stolen Concept Fallacy and nihilism. And I think that it's a great argument against nihilism. But yeah, I'm just going to jump right into it. I think that everything that you throw at nihilism, it gets shot down by skeptical criticism, because I don't think that the answer or I don't think you can prove everything beyond a reasonable doubt, right? You can get to the axiom, you know, you can get to the stolen concept fallacy and say, yeah, if we base our decisions off formal logic, then yes, nihilism is definitely not true and we can discount it. But I think where nihilism starts is beyond the parameters of formal logic. And I think that that's one issue, right? I'll accept that that's a bad thing. But I do think that if you look at everything extremely skeptically and keep asking why, you will get to the point that that I like to call the Munchausen trilemma, which I believe is I can't remember the word either, but it's
like a paradox.
Well, no, I was going to say that credited to Agrippa, one of the ancient Greek philosophers. Mm-hmm. But yes, it is a paradox. That's what I would say. It does disprove itself, but it also disproves everything else. So what do you think about that?
How do we get there? Can you give me an example of this place that we're in where this trilemma occurs?
Okay, yeah. So let's just use the stolen concept fallacy as an example.
Okay.
When I say you can't prove anything, you would say, well, you have to be able to prove something to say that, right? Because that you're making an objective remark. You're saying that this is an objective truth. But if we can't know anything, how do you know that, right?
I would ask,
how do you know that? How do I need to know something to know to say I know something? And right there, right, that doesn't make any sense.
But my question would be, why did you say that thing? If we can't know anything, why did you say that in the first place? Or am I just adding to the paradox of it?
Well, interesting. So that's the thing, is it doesn't make sense.
Right? Yeah.
When we get down to it, things don't make sense. That's, you know, that's the whole point with nihilism, is nothing means anything. But in saying that and talking about it, right, are you subjectively adding meaning to it, or, you know, what are you doing?
Well, let me ask you this. Let me learn a little bit more about how you got there and how this was compelling to you originally. What did you read? How did you learn about would you call nihilism a philosophy? I think you would, right?
Yeah, I would call it, especially moral nihilism, I would say, is definitely a philosophy.
Okay, so how did you get there?
It was a Facebook page called Nihilism Means Nothing to Me.
Yeah.
And it was run by, I don't know the guy's real name, but, you know, he goes by VX on the internet. And I started following that page, and he does these graphics that explain different things in, you know, whatever he's talking about, from semantics to straight up epistemology. You know, that's where I got it from, was these short little paragraphs. And I watched him debate people. Not, it wasn't really debating, because you can't debate a nihilist. It was just, you know, arguing with people about it. And eventually I was like, okay, yeah, I agree with you. We can't prove anything. But then, like I talked about on your show, I don't want to get into that yet, but
okay.
You know, that's how I came to that.
Have you ever read maybe somebody like, what was his name? Donald Crosby wrote about nihilism. Oh. Nietzsche?
I've heard of Nietzsche. I've read maybe an essay or two from him. And of course, his little quotes that he has.
Now, the interesting thing about Nietzsche was like the last great German idealist of the 19th century. I think he actually died in the year 1900. So we've talked about objectivism when you were on my show last summer. And you can see a lot of Nietzsche in Rand, you know, in her philosophy, but you can also see a lot of Nietzsche in like Hitler. And those two people, Rand and Hitler, they're quite different, you know, different philosophies, different aims, different ideas. It was basically what happened in Central and Eastern Europe that Rand was philosophizing against, you know. I mean, she grew up in the Soviet Union. So that really heavy self-sacrifice, collectivism, it's interesting that you could see the influence of Nietzsche in both of their works. And what that tells me is that a lot of what Nietzsche wrote is pretty open to interpretation, right? But it seems like even though nihilism is an idea that you could probably trace back, like most philosophical paradigms, to ancient Greece, right? But it really seems to be, to me, Nietzsche that influenced it. Nietzsche was the one who said, God is dead.
Yeah.
You know? And there, for me, even though I was critical of it before, I think it certainly has some redeeming values, right? Like, if you look at how people tried to find meaning in the world throughout most of time, I mean, how did they do it? They understood that they were just kind of suffering through their lives. I mean, you know, 200 years ago, 500 years ago, there was probably a lot more suffering. Life was a lot shorter. Death probably seemed much more inevitable. And I think human beings had to tell themselves a story that all of this was worth something. And the way they did that was create these kind of alternate universes, you know? So you could, I mean, even though like the Christian idea of heaven is like probably been the most successful and popular alternative world idea, you also have Plato's Forms, you know, that's a kind of alternate reality. Kant and the what did he call it? The noumenal world. So that there would be meaning. Let's just, I mean, this, we could go crazy with this, but let's just focus on the Christian idea of heaven, that you will realize the meaning of your existence after all of this suffering. So Nietzsche, who greatly influenced the philosophy of nihilism, said, you know, that's all nonsense, basically. There is no other realm. There is no other existence. And I think because, as I mentioned earlier, he was open to interpretation. He was very widely interpretable. A lot of people just said, oh, okay, life is meaningless.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And that's what, you know, nihilists get into, is we don't have an objective truth to go off of, but people make that up, right? And that's what I think axioms are. They're foundations that are easy to live off of. They're useful. And, you know, for Christians, that belief in heaven is also useful. And I think that there is a point to having these social constructs. And I think that even though that we, I would claim that, no, we don't have objective knowledge, I would say that that's a stupid thing to say, because who cares?
Yeah.
It certainly seems that I know something and I'm going to live my life like what I'm seeing is true, because it would be terrible to just sit there wondering, you know, am I really sitting down in this chair? Maybe I'm a tree. You know, those are stupid questions, right?
Sure.
But when we get into deep philosophy, I think that's where it gets useful. And I think where nihilism is useful is to break everything down to just the bare minimum of, okay, yeah, we don't know anything. But then, you know, scale it back and say, is there a point to that? Is that a useful philosophy? And, you know, of course, it's not in the real world. And I think that's where I take up objectivism, is with axioms.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that the acceptance of the idea of nihilism was maybe from, I can't say that it all came from Nietzsche, because like I said, it existed before that. But he was certainly, I think, the person who popularized it and pushed it into the 20th century. Like most of the prevailing 20th century philosophies seem to have their roots in the German stuff from the 19th century. So I think it's fair to say that Nietzsche popularized this idea, but I don't think people looked closely enough at what he was saying. People saw him as kind of this evil character because he said things like humans are just herd animals, but he wasn't saying it that's like, oh yeah, here they are and here aren't they terrible? Here's how you control them. He was looking back at a pretty devastating century, especially where he lived, you know, in the area that's Germany today. And it was really kind of, I think, sad. He was a depressive character generally, but he believed that everybody had potential, that they could choose the path they set in life. But most people just wanted to walk down what was basically safe, you know, and mediocre. And that seemed fine to them. And this is where I think he might start to sound less like a guy who influenced Hitler and more like somebody who influenced objectivism and Rand. And a big part of his message was, I think the phrase he used was, become who you are. Recognize what your higher self is. Stop repressing this inner voice just because it speaks to you in a demanding way. Don't be a sucker. Don't be part of the herd. Don't be a sheep, you know? And I think he was like almost angry at people because they just let fear and laziness run their lives. And he thought that people should aspire to be something greater. So then maybe we shift back to somebody like Hitler, and he says, ooh, I aspire to be something greater. He sure did. You know, it depends on how you define the word great. But Nietzsche wasn't all over the place in what he was saying, but I guess the interpretation of him was all over the place. I really think that if you read him closely, and I've read some of his stuff, but you can also see a lot of stoicism. Some stoicism in what Nietzsche wrote as well. Did you hear the stoicism shows that Bill Buebert and I did?
Yeah, those were great.
Yeah, I think a big part of it was that he believed that people were like these cowards because they were so afraid of any kind of suffering, any kind of setback, any kind of pain. But he said if people are going to become these great men, yeah, that path is going to be filled with challenges. It's going to have pain in it. There's going to be setbacks along the way. People only see this negative side of suffering, that like, oh, something is wrong with me because I'm not having a great time right now. And what he told people to do, and what he seemed pretty good at doing himself, was to embrace discomfort. You know, the same way somebody goes to a gym and puts like weights that could crush their rib cage on top of them and lifts them up and down again, embracing discomfort for some kind of end, you know? And that relates to stoicism. It relates to any kind of plateau breaking that you need to do in life. Embracing, I don't want to say pain, but definitely not being afraid to get uncomfortable. He would have said, and I would agree, that there's wisdom in pain if you utilize it, you know? So if people just leave Nietzsche at kind of like, oh, yeah, you know, the world is meaningless. Look at what a bunch of suckers we are. You know, that's kind of disempowering. But if they follow it through to see what the turnaround for all of that is, yeah, it relates to the power of the individual, which is present in objectivism, which is present in stoicism. That's a great message, right? Why are you looking outside of yourself for meaning in life? You know, or why are you looking into a spirit world? You know, like when you die, you'll go to heaven. That's where you'll find meaning after you suffer periodically and then eventually die on this planet after, you know, a long time ago, 40 years and maybe today 70 or 80 years. That's just a really disempowering way to look at life. So the idea is that you can find meaning. You don't have to ask this big, broad question, what is the meaning of life? I think what he was asking people to do is, what is the meaning of my life as an individual, you know, and can I become this higher self? And, you know, I don't want this to sound anti-philosophical, but I don't see why it needs to be more complicated than that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a lot of what has driven me in philosophy, learning philosophy, is, you know, of course, asking questions about, you know, the universe and how we work, and especially how people work. But, you know, when I first got introduced into nihilism, you know, my immediate thought, at least what I think, was not, well, okay, life is meaningless, I should do whatever I want.
Mm-hmm.
But that is what a lot of people do think, like you said. But I don't think that that's the point of nihilism and what Nietzsche would say. But so, you know, I think that it's a good place to start, especially with epistemological and metaphysical nihilism. You know, what's out there and what do we know? It's good to ask those questions and, you know, get to that baseline of, okay, I can't prove anything, but that is pointless, like what we've said. But being able to look back and remember that we can't really be for sure about anything. And having that humbling experience, I think, has been beneficial for me. And I think it's good to remember that we're just people. And sure, we can come up with some great things, but to remember that, you know, we're not all that great. And I think that nihilism can do that in some ways. And I think that there are other philosophies that do that as well.
Well, I would want to learn more about it to see how it's actually practiced. Remember, and this is where it goes back to our last conversation where I said it's an interesting collection of thoughts. Objectivism is more of a philosophy for living on Earth. And when I talk to other or people who would identify as relativists like Thaddeus Russell, you know, the question, I said this in our last conversation, but I'll say it again. Do you live your life that way, or do you live your life like there's some kind of objective rules? Do you live your life like 2 + 2 is whatever? Do you live your life like 2 + 2 = 4? And the reason why I said want to see it practiced is because as we go through like the different branches of philosophy, yeah, the morals and ethics of it, which is basically, correct me if I'm wrong, denying the idea that there's any kind of objectivity in moral principles, right?
Yeah, right.
And the epistemological is, I guess it denies that there can be anything that is true or any meaning that can be objective. I've heard like cosmic nihilism discussed, which basically says that we shouldn't even try to make sense out of nature. And I have a hard time, especially with the moral one and the epistemological, I guess we could say epistemological / metaphysical. How does that not lead to a kind of existential nihilism that just is basically about negating the meaning of life? But I don't know. So, I mean, like I said, I would need to see this practiced. I would need to learn more about it.
Right. Yeah, I see that. And it's, I think at least epistemological nihilism, metaphysical nihilism is close to useless, but it's not just complete skeptical criticism of everything and rejecting objective, knowledge and morals. It has this social constructionism there too. I think that's what a lot of nihilists at least come to. And I think that's, you know, where I come at is, yes, okay, I can't prove anything, but people really do seem to believe things. And why do they do that? And I think that that's where at least I hope smart nihilists would take up social constructionism. And that's what that admin of that page on Facebook talked about as well. We certainly can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that everything we know or seem to know is true, but it's much, much easier to live our life like we have this cheeseburger in front of us. And if I eat it, it's going to taste good, right? From, you know, we just have that, those basic frameworks with what our senses perceive and how we think that those are true, that we can trust those, right? And so there are foundations that we build ourselves and humans and societies, individuals, everybody builds those foundations and then we build off from there. Right. So with epistemology, we come up with these axioms. I can't think of all the names off at the top of my head, but, you know, that these things are true. And the reason why, or the reason behind it and how we justify it is that this seems to be true. And we're working off an axiom that we can view and perceive how reality works.
Well, the trick, right? But the trick with an axiom is that it defeats whatever comes up against it by the fact that people have to accept it and use it in the process of any attempt to deny it. Some key examples would be existence, consciousness, identity, right? So all three of those have to be used to deny any of them. If you say existence doesn't exist, I mean, what are we even doing? You know, like what made you tell me that? Who are you? Because here we are. Consciousness, again, you know, we're forming thoughts and sharing them with each other. And identity, which is the only thing that makes those first two useful. We've identified what consciousness is. We've identified to some extent what existence is, or at least a part of what it can be. And then because we are able to label things, we can use language to communicate with each other. So those would be three central axioms, and I would use the word axiom to again state that any attempt to argue against those things requires the acknowledgement of those things. which means that as far as I'm concerned, those debates are over, you know. But I mean, there's still plenty to talk about, but I think anyone would have a hard time disputing those three axioms in any way that I would find, you know, meaningful or convincing.
And I would agree with that too. But, you know, I always start out with extreme skepticism is, well, why do we need to be able to exist to say we exist?
I don't know what to do with that.
So that's what I get to. That's how I got to this point as well. Okay. Yes. Because I think that, we should justify every position that we come up with. Proof needs proof, and proof needs proof, right? And so, and eventually we get to that point. Now, I didn't explain the Munchausen trilemma to you very well, but that's the Munchausen trilemma. There's a great Wikipedia article on it. But it's basically, you either use a circular argument where you say, well, we need to exist because we need to exist, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we have the axiomatic argument where we say, well, that's just our foundation. And we're going to stick with that, right? It's what I call a leap of faith. And, you know, we could get an argument what faith is, but, you know, it's just a basic assumption that we come up with, you know, just because it's useful, I guess. And then there's the regressive argument where we just keep asking why and why and why. So no matter what, I think you get to the Munchausen trilemma where you have to say, this is our foundation, right? Or keep getting back down. Otherwise, you're using a circular argument.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the ideas of objectivism is we don't have any other way to make sense of the world besides the five senses. So to deny that is, at that point in objectivism, it becomes anti-philosophical. That you have five senses through which you observe reality. You can identify things from there. You can remove contradictions and you can make connections too, and you can communicate your findings. If we're denying the first part, there's no point to two people talking. The ways through which we interface with whatever is out there around us are not real or deceiving us. And even that we recognize that our senses do deceive us. You know, there's such a thing as phantom pain. There's colors we can't see. There's smells we can't smell. There are sounds we can't hear. But we know about them, you know, through instrumentation that was developed with those senses. And we will probably discover that there's more out there. You know, whether we're talking about philosophy or science, what's the best evidence right now? What are the best tools we have right at this point? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
So nihilism is definitely interesting and it has some value, especially even though if you reject the other branches of philosophy or you take a nihilistic approach to the other branches of philosophy, by the time you get to politics, that's, like I said before, that's had some bad results in the world. But I think that, you know, nihilism was also at a time in history a valuable answer to this idea that authority needed to be respected and unquestioned and traditions needed to be honored and people needed to have faith. I think it threw a lot of that out, you know, and there was a significant rejection of political norms and standing institutions because of nihilism. People who would identify as nihilists, at least according to some writers, wouldn't bow down before authorities. They wouldn't take anything on faith. They wouldn't revere some tradition just because it had been done for a long time. All of that would be up for question. And that's a valuable answer to basically this faith-based attempt to find meaning in life, you know, where individualism for most of history, I don't think was very valuable to most people. I think there's some Enlightenment thinkers. Certainly, you know, it was paid lip service in documents like the Declaration of Independence, the individual. But it really seemed to be the 20th century and the objectivists that really turned up the volume on the value of the concept of the individual, the recognition of the individual, and the sovereignty of the individual. It's hard to understand a lot of what has happened in history without understanding that that concept was absent throughout most of it. So what I'm saying is I think nihilism did have some value to counter a lot of the philosophical norms before it arrived really with Nietzsche. But it has, in my opinion, some grave dangers as well.
Yeah, and so I would agree with you there, is that it's useful to an extent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it gets us to ask questions. I think that's really the only benefit to it, because it's skepticism taken to the furthest extent.
And so
I think that we do have to move on from that, right? And, you know, I discussed about epistemology, but with ethics, it's the same path that we take. You know, how do we know that ethics exist? Well, okay, you know, we eventually get to the Munchausen trilemma there, and it goes back into epistemology. But what I take as in ethics, I do identify as a nihilist throughout all branches of philosophy except politics. But it's with ethics, it's the complete rejection of any objective principle. But I think that, you know, with our axioms, I think that people act in their rational, or not their rational, but their best perceived self-interest. People want to survive. That's the main thing that drives us. Through natural selection, we've gotten that trait. We're going to do whatever it takes to survive. And then we have some other basic instinctual things that we do based on natural selection, what it took to survive as a species. Started with that rational, I keep saying rational because that's my thing, but it's not rational all the time what people think that they should do, right? It's just acting in your self-interest. I think that's where I start with in ethics. Mm-hmm. And then I identify as a somewhat of a utilitarian, because I think the non-aggression principle has its place, and I think it's a useful principle, but with all ethical principles, I think that it fails the test of, is it actually objective? And I just don't see how it can be. I think that a lot of people misunderstood it. I just put out a show with a guy named Jim Jesus, and he did a great explanation of how the non-aggression principle should be viewed and used. You know, people start out with aggression is bad, black and white, right there. You know, if a kid takes my flower, shoot him right on the spot. I have the moral justification to do that. But that's not really what the non-aggression principle should be used for, right? It's much more complicated and complex with polycentric law, which I can't explain. But it is really more complicated than just black and white, especially with the non-aggression principle. So I think that it's a useful thing to use. But I think that starting out with rational self-interest, doing what's best for us in a logical way, like Thaddeus Russell discussed with you, I think that's the best place to start out with. And coincidentally, you almost always get to the point of non-aggression, right? You just don't hurt people because you're going to get hurt.
Yeah. Well, I think that rational self-interest is a huge part of it. Really, just to go back to objectivism, that's basically what the morality of objectivism is, right? To come to understand what is in our self-interest, to understand what will produce the happiest, the most beneficial conditions in our lives. Rarely would you think that, you'd have to set up a pretty cockamamie system for some people to be able to use violence to benefit. We obviously have a very large system like that in the world today, but without that, self-interest would basically, I'm trying to think of examples, but as far as being the initiator of force, where would that ever guarantee benefits?
And the only place that I can think of is if you have a system of authority where you are controlling people. That's the only time you can benefit from it, is if you are the government.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you look at anything else, right, it's just not a good idea for yourself and for society as a whole. It's just not a good idea. The whole thing is that, and we talked about this when I was on your show, is that I'm a pragmatic, right? I understand that nihilism has its place, right? I still identify as a nihilist, but when it comes to real life, it's just not useful. And then I guess I would consider myself an objectivist, because, you know, I agree up pretty much with everything that I've heard of Rand up until politics. But we don't need to discuss that right now.
Well, we agree there anyway. I mean, that's where they didn't do very well there. They're not doing very well there today. You know, I mean, these people still exist. They've gotten worse. You know, she was actually probably their best political spokesperson. So we can agree that even though objectivism does stress the need for free markets, for capitalism in its purest form, not whatever it is today, but free markets, we could say, it's right there. But as far as how society should be organized based on a system of ethics, which is what that branch of philosophy is all about, no, they don't do a very great job there.
Yeah, and we definitely agree. But for a long time, I was really critical of the non-aggression principle. And the way it was explained to me, you know, I just hear, oh, it's black and white, right? And I don't like that. I don't like black and white descriptions of anything. It's just too easy, right? Everything seems to have a deeper level. And it was recently explained to me that it goes a lot deeper with, like I said, polycentric law. I don't think that the non-aggression principle is axiomatically true, that it's the objective moral principle. But I think it is very useful because, you know, it's just in our best self-interest to follow it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's actually, I'd like to hear before I answer just a little bit more about why you've come to that conclusion.
Well, it started out with nihilism, right? And it started out with asking the why.
Yeah.
And you know, I'll agree that that's not, eventually it's not useful, but I just don't see how ethical principles can be considered objective even in a realistic situation where we step back from extreme criticism.
Let's take the word ethics out of it for a minute and to say that whoever is taking action, if that person is doing something that goes against their rational self-interest, that is an at the very least unwise, but probably unhealthy and dangerous behavior to take actions against your self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if that's somebody's understanding of the non-aggression principle, that even though violating the non-aggression principle might produce the illusion of all kinds of exciting short-term benefits, you know, that what does that do to a person's, I mean, forget conscience. Like, let's just assume the person doesn't even have a conscience. You know, let's assume the person is a sociopath. But if they continue to do this, I mean, sooner or later, there is going to be a consequence for that action, right? Like,
yeah.
Very few people could get away with that kind of behavior long term unless there was some kind of artificial system that protected them. And there could be other artificial systems besides the state, but that's certainly the biggest in the world today, where it's creating this skewed ethical code or just this nonsensical ethical code. And so maybe it can change based on situations. So if the, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm starting to ramble here a little bit, but if somebody's understanding of non-aggression, let's just say, is rational self-interest, I'm fine with that.
Okay. Yeah, all right. So yeah, and that's what drew me towards the rational self-interest. But, you know, I consider myself a utilitarian. I don't like to use that word because of the connotations behind it. But then again, I also use anarchist. So I start out with my foundations of ethics is everybody acts in their self-interest. And it'd be really great if people were smart about it, if they looked at it from a rational point of view. And I think that is the point to get to. But then I also think that having freedom is the best way to organize a society, to have a lack of a system so that people can have what they want in life, because nobody thinks exactly the same way. Everybody has different subjective preferences.
Yes.
Some people want to have a communist commune, but other people don't, right? I don't want to live in a nudist colony, and I'm not going to force anybody else not to live in that nudist colony, right? I think that everybody should be able to have their own little system just as long as they don't coerce people. And I think that the only way to get there is to have nobody doing it, right? Right? I guess that's self-explanatory. If that's the if people aren't forcing others to do things, people are going to be happier, right? Because they can be able to do what they want. So I think that's where I get anarchy. And that's why I'm an anarchist, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's one of the ways that I try to explain school to young people. Like, think about the things that you choose in your life, right? They're the things that are fun. They're the things that you're enthusiastic about. They're the things that you look forward to. Now think about the things that suck in your life. And you'll probably find that they all have some level of compulsion or full compulsion in them. Happiness doesn't exist where people are forced to do everything that they do. I mean, how could it? Unless somebody was delusional or masochistic, I guess. I mean, people are happy when they are, you know, in charge of their own actions and their processes and activities in life.
Exactly. And I think that that's a utilitarian thing to say, right? But it depends on where you base your ethics is what I think is where utilitarianism comes from.
If
your foundation is to create the best world possible through whatever means, then you're utilitarian.
Yeah.
But if you have some sort of limits on that, I guess, is where you're not.
Well, I mean, there's a catch with utilitarianism, right? And the way I sum it up, it starts out sounding like it's going to be really great. Greatest happiness. You got me so far. But then the second part is for the greatest number, right? So now all of these possibilities for self-sacrifice, you know, sacrifice of the individual, right? Because that's very collectivistic, the greatest happiness for the greatest number. That is basically what that philosophy is all about, as I understand it.
Yeah, well, and I hear that a lot from people, but the way I learned about it was that it is for the greatest number of people, but I think that the greatest number of people is everybody, right? I think that we should be, if we're going to use utilitarianism, you have to be benefiting everybody as much as you can. Otherwise, you're not actually creating the best system or doing the best thing you can. But you have to think win-win rather than let's kill 49% of people just to save 51.
Well, okay. So if we bring, you know, win-win, because especially in the political realm, everything is win-lose, right? So that's where something like utilitarianism becomes and has been very, very dangerous. But if we're talking about, I mean, another way to think about it is like utilitarian on an individual level, which is like now I'm just making things up. But to me, that's kind of objectivism, right?
Well, it is. That's what the rational self-interest is. It's doing what's best for me. Mm-hmm. And then utilitarianism is doing what's best for society.
Well, yeah, but then the politics has to come into it. Like, who is the decider? Who's the person with the clipboard going around saying, yes, we've achieved, by my metrics, the greatest happiness for the greatest number? It's certainly been tried. It has certainly been tried, definitely in the 20th century in numerous locations around the world. Yeah, I think that I agree with what you're saying. I understand what you're saying, and I think we might just be disconnecting a little bit on the terminology, because the word definitely brings up a lot of strong feelings for me based on, you know, what I've known about the philosophy in the past.
Right, and that's why I don't like to use that term.
Sure, yeah, I understand that.
But I haven't came up with something better. So, but I think that you can use utilitarianism to justify anarchism, because anarchism is the absence of authority. And when you don't have authority bossed around people what to do, you have this option to do whatever you want, right? And you can have whichever system that you want, right? If you want to have a socialist republic, just gather all the socialists and create one. Just don't force anybody to do it. And I think that's what's going to benefit everybody, is not having these one size fits all systems like what the state is. You know, having I keep saying system, but I guess it's just not a system, right? It's where everybody does what they want and nobody gets bossed around, right? That would be the perfect world. And I think that utilitarianism is a philosophy that says, well, I guess it's not actually a utopian philosophy. That's what I was trying to explain. But I guess it's utilitarianism is the process to getting as close as we can get to that point. That's what I think utilitarianism's point is, to get closest to a utopia as we can to benefit everybody.
Oh, I agree. You know, I think there's a lot of ideas and a lot of philosophies that strive for that very thing.
Right.
You know, and then it kind of neglects other concepts like human action, you know, human behavior. And anytime you're talking about a philosophy that is going to have, you know, a political branch to it, well, if it is utopian, it's dangerous, right? Because some people are going to have to conform, you know, they're going to have to be in a line, their behavior is going to have to be predictable and set to make that work as a utopia for everybody. And there's a lot of dangers in utilitarianism in that way, historically, you know. I'll look into it again. You've certainly piqued my interest. But I definitely understand what you're saying.
But and I'm trying to come up with a better term. And I try to use the common good rather than the greater good. But even then, the common good still has that, I guess, a connotation of just evil. Because where people have claimed to be utilitarians, it has not ended up very well. I guess maybe Soviet Russia could be an example. It was not beneficial for everybody. So I don't feel like that was the...
I would say it was beneficial for less than 10 people, ultimately, you know. Not that those systems, because they're so easily corruptible, there obviously were beneficiaries of running society that way, but it was not many. Maybe it was more than 10, but it wasn't many. So let's try this. Let's do one more experiment before we wrap up. You describe to me what you're trying to find a word for the best you can. You want to do that? And
yeah.
Okay.
So doing what's best. That's what it is, I guess.
Doing what's best for
myself and or society. So I describe the self as just doing what my best perceived self-interest is. I guess it's an objectivist thing, right?
Okay. So the only thing I would take objection to is when you say doing the best for myself and or society. Like I would take doing the best for myself, or I would take doing my best for myself and society. But myself or society, that's problematic. That's utilitarian to me, right? So you obviously want to do the best for yourself, right? We all want to do the best for ourselves, but we'd also like to live in harmonious surroundings, right? Which is just basically an extension of doing the best for ourselves.
Yeah.
So, okay. I mean, I'm not trying to put ideas in your head, but I think that what you're talking about is, you know, really in line with a lot of what objectivism was originally intended to be, you know, as a philosophy, you know, especially the self-interest piece. You know, I would encourage you. I mean, I don't know. I know we talked about this before, but I would just encourage you to take a look at what's there. There's a great resource. I hate that they call the site this, but AynRand.org is like a really, it's got like a really user-friendly interface that you can, you know, maybe spend an hour on this site and have a great idea how objectivism goes through the first four branches of philosophy, definitely. You know, it was just really valuable for me because when I started to dabble in this stuff, there seemed to be a lot of philosophical schools that didn't seem to be trying to make sense of the world. You know, I remember like when I was starting to get into this stuff, this movie came out. It was kind of about quantum physics, and it was called What the Bleep Do We Know? Have you ever heard of that?
No.
It was a huge hit maybe 10 years ago. And it's just, you know, all of these people with beaded jewelry going, we don't know anything. Ooh, you know, and trying to use science. This was the funnest part of the movie, is that they're trying to use science to make the case that we don't know anything. And I remember that being like strangely appealing to me at the time, you know, the wonder of the world. But going back to a philosophy by which we can live our lives, we're here to make sense of what's going on around us. You know, we're here to make sense of what's going on in our personal lives. We're here to make sense of what's going on inside our bodies, in our immediate surroundings, in our relationships, in our society, in the natural world around us. Like, that's what the human mind is trying to do. And even if I find out later that I'm totally wrong, I decided that the best foot forward was to find the philosophy that's most consistent with a human being's quest to be successful living on Earth. That was objectivism. And it's not like I, you know, maybe I'm really hyping it up here. It's definitely got its problems. It completely fails in one whole branch of philosophy. And a lot of voluntarist types and anarchist types have done their best to correct that, to help objectivism evolve, to also point out like all of the things that were written within the objectivist school that contradict this caricature that people have of it, that it's just about, here's a guide to be selfish, you know, to get away, to feel okay about hurting other people. It's not any of that. And that's all covered. There's a great book that Rand wrote called The Virtue of Selfishness that deals with that, that this is not, we're not, no one is talking about a license to do whatever you want at the expense of others. You know, why would that be? That's already been tried. Ayn Rand would say, that's the world I was born into, you know, in Russia. That's not what I'm trying to do. So there's a lot of value there. There are a lot of problems. It's an interesting study for somebody interested in philosophy, because you get to see where these people who are writing from mostly like the 50s to the 70s, where they hit home runs and where they struck out. And I think that's a valuable exercise.
Yeah, so I'll look into that. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Yeah, this was a great conversation. I think I'm going to have to split this up in two. I'm going to take the education part, make a show, and then I'll take this philosophy part.
Awesome.
Because it's so long. Wrapping up notes, places that people can find you, like School Sucks, and any other things you want to include about that.
Yeah, absolutely. My website is schoolsucksproject.com, and it's pretty easy to search the site if you're going looking for some specific educational thing. We've done series on the one you mentioned, Logic Saves Lives. We've done other critical thinking series as well, the Trivium. We've done series about communication. There's like a big series drop down menu where you can see all this stuff. We did a Young Person's Guide to Politics. We've done series about what I identified as the hidden lessons of school. So, and we've done series about things like permaculture, stoicism, as we talked about. And people can subscribe to our YouTube channel. The username is School Sucks Podcast. And follow me on Twitter, School Sucks Show. And if you want to like join our conversation, the best place to do that is just to search Facebook for School Sucks Project. It's a group. It's got about 1,000 members. And there's some pretty lively conversation in there sometimes. And can you just give your website too, so if I repost this, people can know where to find you if they didn't hear our first conversation?
Yeah, yeah. an-yak.com. It's an-yak.com. This is the Anarcho-Yakabilism podcast. And you can find us on Facebook as well.
Yeah, I just want to say thanks. And I think you're doing great work on your show. I'm really happy that, you know, 6 or 7 months after we first talked, this is still moving forward. It seems to be really successful. I think it's awesome that you're a regular on the Freedom Fiends. And I wish you best of luck, and we'll definitely talk again soon.
And I wanted to say, I told my dad I was going to interview you, and he's a really big fan as well. My principal, a father, he really enjoys the show. He and I listen to it on our drives into town and stuff. But he wanted me to tell you that, you know, he really appreciates what you do.
Oh, that's great. You know, I did see that he wound up commenting on the show that I had you on, and I really appreciated that, and I just realized I never got back to him. I never really acknowledged it. So please return the appreciation to your dad. That means a lot to me. And I'm really, really glad that he's listening. That's very, very cool.